This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present. Don't think of an elephant. Know your values and frame the debate. The new 10th Anniversary Edition by George Lakoff. Narrated by Chris Sorensen.
Preface. 10 years ago, in 2004, when the first edition of this book appeared, hardly anyone had heard of or thought about, much less discussed, how social and political issues were framed. Framing was an unknown and undiscussed concept outside of the academic field of frame semantics. Don't Think of an Elephant became a bestseller and changed all that. Discussions of how issues are framed are now commonplace in the national media. Millions of people hear the word frame in discussion of issues and understand, at least basically, what it means. That is a lot for one small book to have accomplished. But Don't Think of an Elephant had higher goals. At the time, the Republicans were doing a much better job at framing issues their way than the Democrats were. Republican framing superiority had played a major part in their takeover of Congress in 1994. I and others had hoped that starting in 2004, a widespread understanding of how framing worked would allow Democrats to reverse the trend. In the 2008 election, Barack Obama led a Democratic sweep of the White House and Congress. Using far superior framing, as well as superior on-the-ground tactics, besides being a far superior candidate. I had hoped that the superior framing would continue. It didn't. Almost immediately after Obama's inauguration in 2009, the Republicans regained framing superiority in public discourse, and that played a major role in the ascendancy of the Tea Party in Congress and in state houses throughout the nation. Now Republicans are setting their framing sights on the cities as well as the states. What happened? This 10th anniversary edition of Don't Think of an Elephant will do more than just recap what framing is and how it works. The goal of this edition is to explain what happened, why the Democrats have gone back to losing framing wars, and what can be done about it. That's a tall order. Let's get started. We will recap Framing 101 and then go on to Framing 102 and beyond. George Lakoff, Berkeley, California, June 2014. Introduction. Reframing is social change. We think with our brains. We have no choice. It may seem that certain politicians think with other parts of their anatomy, but they too think with their brains. Why does this matter for politics? Because all thought is physical. Thought is carried out by neural circuits in the brain. We can only understand what our brains allow us to understand. The deepest of those neural structures are relatively fixed. They don't change readily or easily. And we are mostly unconscious of their activity and impact. In fact, about 98% of what our brains are doing is below the level of consciousness. As a result, we may not know all or even most of what in our brains determines our deepest moral, social, and political beliefs. And yet we act on the basis of those largely unconscious beliefs. My field, cognitive science, has found ways to study unconscious as well as conscious modes of thought. As a cognitive scientist, my job is to help make the unconscious conscious, to find out and let the world know what is determining our social and political behavior. I believe that such knowledge can lead to positive social and political change. Why? Because what goes on in people's brains matters. Do we have to go to the neural level to understand our politics? In some cases, yes. Diving that deep will be important, and we will discuss the brain when necessary. But on the whole, the most important brain structures for our politics can be studied from the perspective of the mind. They are called frames. Frames. Frames are mental structures that shape the way we see the world. As a result, they shape the goals we seek, the plans we make, the way we act, and what counts as a good or bad outcome of our actions. In politics, our frames shape our social policies and the institutions we form to carry out policies. To change our frames is to change all of this. Reframing is social change. You can't see or hear frames. They are part of what we cognitive scientists call the cognitive unconscious, structures in our brains that we cannot consciously access but know by their consequences. What we call common sense is made up of unconscious, automatic, effortless inferences that follow from our unconscious frames. We also know frames through language. All words are defined relative to conceptual frames. When you hear a word, its frame is activated in your brain. Yes, in your brain. As the title of this book shows, even when you negate a frame, you activate the frame. If I tell you, don't think of an elephant, you'll think of an elephant. Though I found this out first in the study of cognitive linguistics, it has begun to be confirmed by neuroscience. When a macaque monkey grasps an object, a certain group of neurons in the monkey's ventral premotor cortex, which choreographs actions but does not directly move the body, are activated. When the monkey is trained not to grasp the object, most of those neurons are inhibited. They turn off. But a portion of the same neurons used in grasping still turn on. That is, to actively not grasp requires thinking of what grasping would be. Not only does negating a frame activate that frame, but the more it is activated, the stronger it gets. The moral for political discourse is clear. When you argue against someone on the other side using their language and their frames, you are activating their frames, strengthening their frames in those who hear you, and undermining your own views. For progressives, this means avoiding the use of conservative language and the frames that the language activates. It means that you should say what you believe using your language, not theirs. Reframing. When we successfully reframe public discourse, we change the way the public sees the world. We change what counts as common sense. Because language activates frames, new language is required for new frames. Thinking differently requires speaking differently. Reframing is not easy or simple. It's not a matter of finding some magic words. Frames are ideas, not slogans. Reframing is more a matter of accessing what we and like-minded others already believe unconsciously, making it conscious and repeating it till it enters normal public discourse. It doesn't happen overnight. It is an ongoing process. It requires repetition and focus and dedication. To achieve social change, reframing requires a change in public discourse, and that requires a communication system. Conservatives in America have developed a very extensive and sophisticated communication system that progressives have not yet developed. Fox News is only the tip of the iceberg. Progressives need to understand what an effective communication system is and develop one. Reframing without a system of communication accomplishes nothing. Reframing, as we discuss in this book, is about honesty and integrity. It is the opposite of spin and manipulation. It is about bringing to consciousness the deepest of our beliefs and our modes of understanding. It is about learning to express what we really believe in a way that will allow those who share our beliefs to understand what they most deeply believe and to act on those beliefs. Framing is also about understanding those we disagree with most. Tens of millions of Americans vote conservative. For the most part, they are not bad people or stupid people. They are people who understand the world differently and have a different view of what is right. All politics is moral. When a political leader puts forth a policy or suggests how we should act, The implicit assumption is that the policy or action is right, not wrong. No political leader says, here's what you should do. Do it because it is wrong, pure evil, but do it. No political leader puts forth policies on the grounds that the policies don't matter. Political prescriptions are assumed to be right. The problem is that different political leaders have different ideas about what is right. All politics is moral, but not everybody operates from the same view of morality. Moreover, much of moral belief is unconscious. We are often not even aware of our own most deeply held moral views. As we shall see, the political divide in America is a moral divide. We need to understand that moral divide and understand what the progressive and conservative moral systems are. Most importantly, a great many people operate on different and inconsistent moral systems in different areas of their lives. The technical term is biconceptualism. Here the brain matters even more. Each moral system is, in the brain, a system of neural circuitry. How can inconsistent systems function smoothly in the same brain? The answer is twofold. One, mutual inhibition. When one system is turned on, the other is turned off. And two, neural binding to different issues, when each system operates on different concerns. Biconceptualism is central to our politics, and it is vital to understand how it works. We will be discussing it throughout this book. What is rationality? The brain and cognitive sciences have radically changed our understanding of what reason is and what it means to be rational. Unfortunately, all too many progressives have been taught a false and outdated theory of reason itself, one in which framing, metaphorical thought, and emotion play no role in rationality. This has led many progressives to view that the facts alone will set you free. Progressives are constantly giving lists of facts. Facts matter enormously, but to be meaningful, they must be framed in terms of their moral importance. Remember, you can only understand what the frames in your brain allow you to understand. If the facts don't fit the frames in your brain, the frames in your brain stay and the facts are ignored or challenged or belittled. We will explore those frames in detail in the pages ahead. It is by popular demand that this book is short and informal. It is meant to be a practical guide for both citizen activists and for anyone with a serious interest in politics. Those who want a more systematic and scholarly treatment should read my books, Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, 2nd edition, Thinking Points, Whose Freedom, The Political Mind, and The Little Blue Book, with Elizabeth Welling. And for those just dying to read clearly 600-page academic books and hundreds of articles on both political and academic topics, you can find them on my website, www.georgelakoff.com. But for a quick informative read and your first introduction to framing, start here. It is vital for us, for our country, and for the world that we understand the progressive values on which this country was founded and that made it a great democracy. If we are to keep that democracy, we must learn to articulate those values loud and clear. If progressives are to win the future, we must present a clear moral vision to the country, a moral vision common to all progressives. It must be more than a laundry list of facts, policies, and programs. It must present a moral alternative, one traditionally American, one that lies behind everything Americans are proud of. This update of the original version of Don't Think of an Elephant is written in the service of that vision. Enjoy. Part 1. Framing 101. Theory and Application. Chapter 1. Framing 101. How to Take Back Public Discourse. January 21, 2004. On this date, I spoke extemporaneously to a group of about 200 progressive citizen activists in Sausalito, California. Some updates have been made. When I teach the study of framing at Berkeley in Cognitive Science 101, the first thing I do is give my students an exercise. The exercise is, don't think of an elephant. Whatever you do, do not think of an elephant. I've never found a student who is able to do this. Every word like elephant evokes a frame which can be an image or other kinds of knowledge. Elephants are large, have floppy ears, tusks, and a trunk, live naturally in jungles, are associated with circuses, and so on. The word is defined relative to that frame. When we negate a frame, we evoke the frame. Richard Nixon found that out the hard way. While under pressure to resign during the Watergate scandal, Nixon addressed the nation on TV. He stood before the nation and said, "I am not a crook." And everybody thought about him as a crook. This gives us a basic principle of framing. When you are arguing against the other side, do not use their language. Their language picks out a frame, and it won't be the frame you want. Let me give you an example. On the day that George W. Bush arrived in the White House, the phrase tax relief started coming out of the White House. It was repeated almost every day thereafter, was used in the press in describing his policies, and slowly became so much a part of public discourse that liberals started using it. Think of the framing for relief. For there to be relief, there must be an affliction, an afflicted party, and a reliever who removes the affliction and is therefore a hero. And if people try to stop the hero, those people are villains for trying to prevent relief. When the word tax is added to relief, the result is a metaphor. Taxation is an affliction, and the person who takes it away is a hero, and anyone who tries to stop him is a bad guy. This is a frame. It is made up of ideas like affliction and hero. The language that evokes the frame comes out of the White House, and it goes into press releases, goes to every radio station, every TV station, every newspaper. And soon the New York Times is using tax relief. And it is not only on Fox. It is on CNN, it is on NBC, it is on every station because it is the president's tax relief plan. And soon the Democrats are using tax relief and shooting themselves in the foot. It is remarkable. We have seen Democrats adopting the conservative view of taxation as an affliction when they have offered tax relief for the middle class. They were accepting the conservative frame. The conservatives had set a trap. The words draw you into their worldview. That is what framing is about. Framing is about getting language that fits your worldview. It is not just language. The ideas are primary, and the language carries those ideas, evokes those ideas. There was another noteworthy example of conservative framing in George W. Bush's State of the Union address in January 2005. This one was a remarkable metaphor to find in a State of the Union address. President Bush said, "We do not need a permission slip to defend America." What was going on with a permission slip? He could have just said, "We won't ask permission." But talking about a permission slip is different. Think about when you last needed a permission slip. Think about who has to ask for a permission slip. Think about who is being asked. Think about the relationship between them. Those are the kinds of questions you need to ask if you are to understand contemporary political discourse. While you are contemplating them, I want to raise other questions for you. My work on politics began when I asked myself just such a question. It was back in the fall of 1994. I was watching election speeches and reading the Republicans' Contract with America. The question I asked myself was this: What do the conservatives' positions on issues have to do with each other? If you are a conservative, what does your position on abortion have to do with your position on taxation? What does that have to do with your position on the environment? On foreign policy? How do these positions fit together? What does being against gun control have to do with being for tort reform? What makes sense of the linkage? I could not figure it out. I said to myself, these are strange people. Their collection of positions make no sense. But then a thought occurred to me. I have exactly the opposite position on every issue. What do my positions have to do with one another? And I could not figure that out either. That was extremely embarrassing for someone who does cognitive science and linguistics. Eventually, the answer came, and it came from a very unexpected place. It came from the study of family values. I had asked myself why conservatives were talking so much about family values, and why did certain values count as family values while others did not? Why would anyone in a presidential campaign, in congressional campaigns, and so on, when the future of the world was being threatened by nuclear proliferation and global warming, constantly talk about family values? At this point, I remembered a paper that one of my students had written some years back that showed that we all have a metaphor for the nation as a family. We have founding fathers, the daughters of the American Revolution. We send our sons to war. This is a natural metaphor because we usually understand large social groups like nations in terms of small ones, like families or communities. Given the existence of the metaphor linking the nation to the family, I asked the next question. If there are two different understandings of the nation, do they come from two different understandings of family? I worked backward. I took the various positions on the conservative side and on the progressive side, and I said, let's put them through the metaphor from the opposite direction and see what comes out. I put in the two different views of the nation, and out popped two different models of the family, a strict father family and a nurturant parent family. You know which is which. Now, when I first did this, and I'll tell you about the details in a minute, I was asked to give a talk at a linguistics convention. I decided I would talk about this discovery. In the audience were two members of the Christian Coalition who were linguists and good friends of mine. Excellent linguists. And very, very good people. Very nice people. People I liked a lot. They took me aside at the party afterward and said, "Well, this strict father model of the family, it's close, but not quite right. We'll help you get the details right. However, you should know all this. Have you read Dobson?" I said, "Who?" They said, "James Dobson." I said, "Who?" They said, "You're kidding. He's on 3,000 radio stations." I said, "Well, I don't think he's on NPR. I haven't heard of him." They said, "Well, you live in Berkeley." "Where would I... Does he write stuff?" "Oh," they said, "oh, yes. He has sold millions of books. His classic is Dare to Discipline." My friends were right. I followed their directions to my local Christian bookstore, and there I found it all laid out. The strict father model in all its details. Dobson, at the time, was an influential figure in conservative politics, with a $100 to $200 million a year operation, a widely distributed and read column in newspapers all over America, as well as his own zip code because so many people were writing to order his books and pamphlets. He was effectively teaching people how to use the strict father model to raise their kids. And he understood the connection between strict father families, right-wing politics, evangelical religion, laissez-faire economics, and neoconservative foreign policy. The strict father model begins with a set of assumptions. The world is a dangerous place, and it always will be, because there is evil out there in the world. The world is also difficult because it is competitive. There will always be winners and losers. There is an absolute right and an absolute wrong. Children are born bad in the sense that they just want to do what feels good, not what is right. Therefore, they have to be made good. What is needed in this kind of a world is a strong, strict father who can protect the family in the dangerous world, support the family in the difficult world, and teach his children right from wrong. What is required of the child is obedience, because the strict father is a moral authority who knows right from wrong. It is further assumed that the only way to teach kids obedience, that is, right from wrong, is through punishment, painful punishment when they do wrong. This includes hitting them, and some authors on conservative child rearing recommend sticks, belts, and wooden paddles on the bare bottom. Some authors suggest this start at birth, but Dobson was more liberal. There is no excuse for spanking babies younger than 15 or 18 months of age. Dobson, The New Dare to Discipline, page 65. The rationale behind physical punishment is this. When children do something wrong, if they are physically disciplined, they learn not to do it again. That means they will develop internal discipline to keep themselves from doing wrong so that in the future they will be obedient and act morally. Without such punishment, the world will go to hell. There will be no morality. Such internal discipline has a secondary effect. It is what is required for success in the difficult competitive world. That is, if people are disciplined and pursue their self-interest in this land of opportunity, they will become prosperous and self-reliant. Thus, the strict father model links morality with prosperity. The same discipline you need to be moral is what allows you to prosper. The link is individual responsibility and the pursuit of self-interest. Given opportunity, individual responsibility, and discipline, pursuing your self-interest should enable you to prosper. Now, Dobson was very clear about the connection between the strict father worldview and free market capitalism. The link is the morality of self-interest, which is the conservative version of Adam Smith's view of capitalism. Adam Smith said that if everyone pursues their own profit, then the profit of all will be maximized by the invisible hand, that is, by nature, just naturally. Go about pursuing your own profit and you are helping everyone. This is linked to a general metaphor that views well-being as wealth. For example, if I do you a favor, you say, I owe you one, or I'm in your debt. Doing something good for someone is metaphorically like giving him money. He owes you something, and he says, how can I ever repay you? Apply this metaphor to Adam Smith's law of nature. If everyone pursues her own self-interest, then by the invisible hand, by nature, the self-interest of all will be maximized. That is, it is moral to pursue your self-interest, and there is a name for those people who do not do it. The name is do-gooder. The do-gooder is someone who is trying to help someone else rather than herself and is getting in the way of those who are pursuing their self-interest. Do-gooders screw up the system. In this model, there is also a definition of what it means to become a good person. A good person, a moral person, is someone who is disciplined enough to be obedient to legitimate authority, to learn what is right, to do what is right, and not to do what is wrong, and to pursue their self-interest to prosper and become self-reliant. A good child grows up to be like that. A bad child is one who does not learn discipline, does not function morally, does not do what is right, and therefore is not disciplined enough to become prosperous. She cannot take care of herself and thus becomes dependent. When the good children are mature, they either have learned discipline and can prosper or have failed to learn it. From this point on, the strict father is not to meddle in their lives. This translates politically into no government meddling. Consider what all this means for social programs. It is immoral to give people things they have not earned because then they will not develop discipline and will become both dependent and immoral. This theory says that social programs are immoral because they make people dependent. Promoting social programs is immoral. And what does this say about budgets? Well, if there are a lot of progressives in Congress who think that there should be social programs, and if you believe that social programs are immoral, how do you stop these immoral people? In the strict father frame, it is quite simple. What you have to do is reward the good people, the one whose prosperity reveals their discipline and hence their capacity for morality, with a tax cut, and make it big enough so that there is not enough money left for social programs. As Grover Norquist says, it starves the beast. For example, as a result of the Republican House's refusal to either cut tax loopholes or raise taxes to pay its bills, the 2013 sequester, an across-the-board cut in government programs, was put into place. Here are some examples of what was cut from various government agencies' budgets from a February 20, 2013 article in the Washington Post. The National Institutes of Health, cut by $1.6 billion. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cut by about $303 million. Head Start, cut by over $400 million, kicking 57,000 kids out of the program. FEMA's Disaster Relief Budget, cut by $928 million. Public Housing Support, cut by about $1.74 billion. The FDA, cut by $209 million. NASA, cut by $896 million. Special Education, cut by $827 million. The Energy Department's programs for securing our nukes, cut by $903 million. The National Science Foundation, cut by about $361 million. State Department diplomatic functions, cut by $665 million. Global health programs, cut by $411 million. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, cut by $53 million. The SEC, cut by $74 million. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, cut by $3 million. The Library of Congress, cut by $30 million. The Patent and Trademark Office, cut by $148 million. Conservatives see this as cutting wasteful spending, that is, spending for bad social programs. Are conservatives against all government? No. They are not against the military. They are not against Homeland Security. They are not against tax cuts, loopholes, and subsidies for corporations. They are not against the conservative Supreme Court. There are many aspects of government that they like very much. Subsidies for corporations, which reward the good people, the investors in those corporations, are great. No problem there. But they are against nurturance and care. They are against social programs that take care of people. Early childhood education, Medicaid for the poor, raising the minimum wage, unemployment insurance. That is what they see as wrong. That is what they are trying to eliminate on moral grounds. That is why they are not merely a bunch of crazies or mean and greedy or stupid people, as many liberals believe. What is even scarier is that conservatives are acting on principle, on what they believe is moral. And they have supporters around the country. People who have strict father morality and who apply it to politics are going to believe that this is the right way to govern. Think for a minute about what this says about foreign policy. Suppose you are a moral authority. As a moral authority, how do you deal with your children? Do you ask them what they should do or what you should do? No. You tell them. What the father says, the child does. No backtalk. Communication is one way. It is the same with foreign policy. That is, the president does not engage in diplomacy or ask the help of allies. The president tells. If you are a moral authority, you know what is right. You have power and you use it. You would be immoral yourself if you abandoned your moral authority. Map this onto foreign policy, and it says that you cannot give up sovereignty. The United States, being the best and most powerful country in the world, a moral authority, should not be asking anybody else what to do. We should be using our military power. This belief comes together with a set of metaphors that have run foreign policy for a long time. There is a common metaphor learned in graduate school classes on international relations. It is called the rational actor metaphor. It is the basis of classical realist international relations theory, and in turn it assumes another metaphor, that every nation is a person. Therefore, there are rogue states, there are friendly nations, and so on. And there is a national interest. What does it mean in this worldview to act in your self-interest? In the most basic sense, it means that you act in ways that will help you be healthy and strong. In the same way, by the metaphor that a nation is a person, it is good for a nation to be healthy. That is, economically healthy, defined as having a large GDP, and strong, that is, militarily strong. It is not necessary that all the individuals in the country be healthy, but the company should be, and the country as a whole should have a lot of money. That is the idea. The question is, how do you maximize your self-interest? That is what foreign policy is about. Maximizing self-interest, not working for the interest of all. The rational actor metaphor says that every actor, every person is rational, and that it is irrational to act against your self-interest. Therefore, it is rational for every person to act to maximize self-interest. Then, by the further metaphor that nations are persons, friendly nations, rogue states, enemy nations, and so on, there are adult nations and child nations, where adulthood is industrialization. The child nations are called developing nations or underdeveloped states. Those, again, in this view, are the backward ones. And what should we do? If you are a strict father, you tell the children how to develop. Tell them what rules they should follow and punish them when they do wrong. That is, you operate using, say, the policies of the International Monetary Fund. And who is in the United Nations? Most of the United Nations consists of developing and undeveloped countries. That means they are metaphorical children. Now let's go back to the State of the Union address. Should the United States have consulted the United Nations and gotten its permission to invade Iraq? An adult does not ask for a permission slip. The phrase itself, permission slip, puts you back in grammar school or high school, where you need a permission slip from an adult to go to the bathroom. You do not need to ask for a permission slip if you are the teacher, if you are the principal, if you are the person in power, the moral authority. The others should be asking you for permission. That is what the permission slip phrase in the 2004 State of the Union address was about. Every conservative in the audience got it. They got it right away. Two powerful words, permission slip. What Bush did was evoke the adult-child metaphor for other nations. He said, "We're the adult in charge." He was operating in the strict father worldview, and it did not have to be explained. It is evoked automatically. This is what is done regularly by the conservatives. Finally, there is the conservative view of the moral hierarchy. As we have seen, the rich and those who can take care of themselves are considered more moral than the poor and those who need help. But moral superiority on a wider scope is central to conservative thought. The basic idea is that those who are more moral should rule. How do you know who is more moral? Well, in a well-ordered world, ordered by God, the moral have come out on top. Here is the hierarchy. God above man above nature, adults above children, Western culture above non-Western culture, our country above other countries. These are general conservative values. But the hierarchy goes on, and it explains the oppressive views of more radical conservatives. Men above women, Christians above non-Christians, whites above non-whites, straights above gays. Thus, disobedient children in southern states can be paddled in school with sticks by teachers. Women seeking abortions must undergo embarrassing medical procedures and notification of husbands and fathers. African Americans and Hispanics have voting rights taken away. Legislation against gay marriage is passed by conservative legislatures. In short, the moral hierarchy is an implicit part of the culture wars. Now, let me talk a bit about how progressives understand their morality and what their moral system is. It too comes out of a family model, what I call the nurturant parent model. The strict father worldview is so named because, according to its own beliefs, the father is the head of the family. The nurturant parent worldview is gender neutral. Both parents are equally responsible for raising the children. The assumption is that children are born good and can be made better. The world can be made a better place, and our job is to work on that. The parents' job is to nurture their children and to raise their children to be nurturers of others. What does nurturance mean? It means three things: empathy, responsibility for yourself and others, and a commitment to do your best not just for yourself, but for your family, your community, your country, and the world. If you have a child, you have to know what every cry means. You have to know when the child is hungry, when she needs a diaper change, when she is having nightmares. And you have a responsibility. You have to take care of the child. Since you cannot take care of someone else if you are not taking care of yourself, you have to take care of yourself enough to be able to take care of the child. All this is not easy. Anyone who has ever raised a child knows that it is hard. You have to be strong. You have to work at it. You have to be very competent. You have to know a lot. In addition, all sorts of other values immediately follow from empathy, responsibility for yourself and others, and commitment to do your best for all. Think about it. First, if you empathize with your child, you will provide protection. This comes into politics in many ways. What do you protect your child from? Crime and drugs, certainly. You also protect your child from cars without seat belts, from smoking, from poisonous additives in foods. So progressive politics focuses on environmental protection, worker protection, consumer protection, and protection from disease. These are the things that progressives want the government to protect their citizens from. But there are also terrorist attacks, which liberals and progressives have not been very good at talking about in terms of protection. Protection is part of the progressive moral system, but it has not been elaborated on enough. And on September 11, 2001, progressives did not have a whole lot to say. That was unfortunate, because nurturant parents and progressives do care about protection. Protection is important. It is part of our moral system. Second, if you empathize with your child, you want your child to be fulfilled in life, to be a happy person. And if you are an unhappy, unfulfilled person yourself, you are not going to want other people to be happier than you are. The Dalai Lama teaches us that. Therefore, it is your moral responsibility to be a happy, fulfilled person. Your moral responsibility. Further, it is your moral responsibility to teach your child to be a happy, fulfilled person who wants others to be happy and fulfilled. That is part of what nurturing family life is about. It is a common precondition for caring about others. There are still other nurturant values. If you want your child to be fulfilled in life, the child has to be free enough to seek and possibly find fulfillment. Therefore, freedom is a value. You do not have very much freedom if there is no opportunity or prosperity. Therefore, opportunity and prosperity are progressive values. If you really care about your child, you want your child to be treated fairly by you and by others. Therefore, fairness is a value. If you are connecting with your child and you empathize with that child, you have to have open two-way communication. Honest, open communication. That becomes a value. You live in a community, and that community will affect how your child grows up. Therefore, community building, service to the community, and cooperation in a community become values. To have cooperation, you must have trust. And to have trust, you must have honesty and open two-way communication. Trust, honesty, and open communication are fundamental progressive values, in a community as in a family. These are the nurturant values, and they are the progressive values. As a progressive, you have them. You know you have them. You recognize them. Every progressive political program is based on one or more of these values. That is what it means to be a progressive. There are several types of progressives. How many types? I am asking as a cognitive scientist, not as a sociologist or a political scientist. From the point of view of a cognitive scientist who looks at modes of thought, there are six basic types of progressives, each with a distinct mode of thought. They share all the progressive values but are distinguished by some differences. Socioeconomic progressives think that everything is a matter of money and class, and that all solutions are ultimately economic and social class solutions. Identity politics progressives say it is time for their oppressed group to get its share now. Environmentalists think in terms of sustainability of the earth, the sacredness of the earth, and the protection of native peoples. And they recognize that global warming is the major moral challenge of our time, making all other issues pale by comparison. Civil liberties progressives want to maintain freedoms against threats to freedom. Spiritual progressives have a nurturant form of religion or spirituality. Their spiritual experience has to do with their connection to other people and the world. And their spiritual practice has to do with service to other people and to their community. Spiritual progressives span the full range from Catholics and Protestants to Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, goddess worshippers, and pagan members of Wicca. Anti-authoritarians say there are all sorts of illegitimate forms of authority out there, and we have to fight them, whether they are big corporations or anyone else. All six types are examples of nurturant parent morality. The problem is that many of the people who have one of these modes of thought do not recognize that theirs is just one special case of something more general, and do not see the unity in all the types of progressives. They often think that theirs is the only way to be a true progressive. That is sad. It keeps people who share progressive values from coming together. We have to get past that harmful idea. The other side did it. Until the Tea Party came along. Back in the 1950s, conservatives hated each other. The financial conservatives hated the social conservatives. The libertarians did not get along with the social conservatives or the religious conservatives. And many social conservatives were not religious. A group of conservative leaders got together around William F. Buckley Jr. and others and started asking what the different groups of conservatives had in common and whether they could agree to disagree in order to promote a general conservative cause. They started magazines and think tanks and invested billions of dollars. The first thing they did, their first victory, was getting Barry Goldwater nominated in 1964. He lost, but when he lost, they went back to the drawing board and put more money into organization. During the Vietnam War, they noticed that most of the bright young people in the country were not becoming conservatives. Conservative was a dirty word. Therefore, in 1970, Lewis Powell, just 2 months before he became a Supreme Court justice appointed by Nixon, at the time he was the chief counsel to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, wrote a memo, the Powell Memo. It was a fateful document. He said that the conservatives had to keep the country's best and brightest young people from becoming anti-business. What we need to do, Powell said, is set up institutes within the universities and outside the universities. We have to do research. We have to write books. We have to endow professorships to teach these people the right way to think. After Powell went to the Supreme Court, these ideas were taken up by William Simon, Secretary of the Treasury under Nixon. He convinced some very wealthy people and families with foundations, Coors, Scaife, Olin, to set up the Heritage Foundation, the Olin professorships,